Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santaferadiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to the good folks from the Juan City Flamenco Dance Company. Right now, I would like to welcome Lee Zimmerman. He's the director of this year's Silk Painters International Festival, which is taking place in Santa Fe, starting this weekend and going through the 10th of August. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And joining us by telephone, Mary Shazer. She is the author of the book called Silk, which is published by Yale University Press, and she will be here for the festival as well. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So let's start with you. Mary, you've written this incredible and beautiful book titled Silk. What is silk? Let's start there.
Oh, well, silk is this remarkable fiber. It's made from a single protein called fibrin, and it's produced by the silkworm, which actually just extrudes it just the same way that a spider extrudes spider silk. And then it's, it doesn't need to be spun. It's just twisted together and made thick enough, still very fine, but thick enough so that you can actually manipulate it. And that's the silk that we still use today.
And this may sound like a silly question, but what do silkworms use it for?
They use it to make their cocoon. You know, like and all insects that you see, all, you know, the butterfly, when it comes out, emerges from its cocoon, it's made that cocoon out of a very similar product. And if you left the silkworm undisturbed, it is a kind of caterpillar, it would turn into a little, it looks like a little white moth.
And those animals that make this silk have developed a fiber that is highly useful not only for them, I guess it's probably very adaptive for their protective purposes, but very much so for human purposes. What were the earliest uses by human beings of silk?
Well, we know that they were weaving silk as early as 3,630 BC. That's over 5,000 years ago. But they've also used it for really important things like fishing lines, for example. They were originally all out of silk because it's very, very strong and very elastic. It's as strong as steel, in fact. And so it was important in warfare. The Chinese military used it as a cushion against swords and arrows because they wouldn't penetrate. And it's got on since then really having this dual use as a sort of practical, if you like, technological and military fiber, and then as something that's exquisitely beautiful and is loved around the world.
So when did it become a luxury item? I mean, it's one of those rare commodities that is in itself a kind of currency like gold or silver.
Yes, you've used the right word. It's been a currency, as far as we know, since at least the time of the Kublai Khan, who ruled from 1260 to about 1294, and he issued paper money, the first paper money that was really widely circulated. But it was backed by silk, and so it was called the Silk Note. So it really did, at many points, it had a value actually greater than gold. But it has been a currency for 3,000 years, and in fact, it still is, in some circumstances, used as a currency today.
And it's... So, I mean, where something is valuable and something is beautiful, people fight over it. Have there been wars or conflicts over silk the way there have over, like, oil and gold and so on?
Oh, absolutely. I suppose you might say that silk and the history of warfare are intimately intertwined. If you go on the Internet today and you just look up the Silk Routes or the Silk Road, as it used to be called, you'll find that a lot of the information you get is actually about warfare, because the silk routes, which were established starting in about 650 B.C. and really active up until 100 B.C., they were also the major routes for armies. And so Afghanistan, a place that we hear about all the time now, was, and it still is, an important silk-growing area. But it was transgressed by virtually every army that we know the history of at some point. And part of what they were after was controlling the production of the silk, or being able to tax the silk as it moved from China through to the West.
And so were these roads, these silk roads, actually built for the transportation of silk?
Well, this is a great argument. Some people say yes and some people say no. Certainly we know there were several of them because they had to divert around the great Talamankan Desert that's just on our side, if you like, of China. This desert was and still is a kind of series of shifting sands, so there were several routes that went through there. But certainly the Chinese began trading, we know, for military reasons because they had the marauding nomads and Mongols and, you know, the people like Kublai Khan on their western borders, inland of them, and the Chinese had the silk. It was certainly there that it was developed into the fine product that we know today. And they traded the silk to make peace, really. So they used it as an implement in their military arrangements. They bribed people, basically, with it. And they also traded for the great Mongolian horses, which the Chinese didn't have.
So who got to actually wear silk?
Oh, well, now, it's always been the fiber of the royalty, the rich and famous, so to speak. Now, there was a point in China when so much silk was being grown that it was actually woven in quantities by farmers to pay their taxes with. And so it did become a little more generally available around about, say, 600, 700, 800, something like that. So if you were a banker, say, you know, if today you were the equivalent of a doctor, you would be wearing silk.
Did both men and women wear it?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
Now, one of the features of silk is that it takes color very well, and the history of silk is also the history of the dyeing of silk, and certain colors were considered very valuable.
Oh, yes, that's very, very true. Scarlet is a particularly esteemed color, this very, very, very special vivid red. And the whole point about the way silk takes color, it does, of course, because it's so absorbent of moisture. And this is actually one of the things that also makes it the only fiber that's comfortable in any climate, because it wicks moisture away from your skin. So it keeps you dry in a damp climate. But because it doesn't transfer heat, it also keeps you cool in a hot climate and warm in a cold climate.
So how did the technology of the weaving of silk change? There's damask silk, which I learned from your book is named after Damascus. I never even knew that. There's satin. There's velvet. Tell us about some of these beautifications of the silk fabric making process.
Well, it starts, of course, the history of weaving itself is just a massive topic, so you have to forgive me for, I'll just make it very, very short. Basically, what happens is in China, because they have silk, this is the longest natural fiber and it's very strong, so they start their weaving process using that length and strength as the warp in the loom. Those are the fixed threads that run from the front and back to the loom. And all of the cloths that they develop independently are based on that idea that you have these long, 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 strong threads running in the warp, and then you just intersect with smaller, shorter lengths of threads going across. In the West, on the other hand, they didn't have these long, 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 strong threads, and so they developed different kinds of looms. So the Chinese are the ones who develop the damask-type patterns, and they also begin to develop... it is terribly complicated. You can see, can't you? Never ask a historian for a 10-word answer.
You don't have to give a short answer. This is a long-form program, so you can talk as much as you want.
Okay, well, what happens is, what we know is around about 1000 A.D., all of these different technologies begin to merge because it's Neolithic. The process of weaving is one of the first human endeavors. It's the first technology. It long predates pottery and all these other sort of things. It's long before the Stone Age, even, or it's the earliest part that we know of it. And so, around about 1,000, that is just 1,000 years ago, what we find is that there has been enough communication between all the different regions and their different kinds of weaving so that we actually have in existence by then this full panoply of different types of cloth. So you have the damask, which is essentially just a pattern that appears by virtue of making a different texture in the cloth. There's no change in color at all. It's just texture. You have brocades, which are where you add separate colors. You have beautiful velvets, which are made by introducing a whole different pile to the cloth, and this can be cut away or it can be looped like terry cloth. And then you have all kinds of interesting ways to add, say, stripes, and you can make one stripe tighter than another, so then you get a puckered surface like a seersucker, we would call it today. And also, later, we get the beginning of beautiful, lightweight, sheer nets, which become machine-made laces. And that's all based on the strength of the silk, which can tolerate the tension that's needed in these machines. So I suppose you could say, certainly it's true, that a lot of technological innovation in textiles of all sorts actually begin with silk, because it's strong, it can take all this kind of rough and tumble, and also because it's worth so much, it's worth it to the manufacturer to make it very special, because the product itself, just plain, can be sold for a lot, so they can add all these extra experiments and, you know, trials and error, and still come out with a product that they can make a profit on.
We're talking to Mary Shazer. She is the author of the book Silk, and she will be here this weekend and forward at the Silk Painters International Festival, which we're going to be talking about more in just a couple of minutes. How has the technology of silk making been mechanized, and what still needs to be done by hand?
Well, the technology is extremely sophisticated. The production of silk from the very beginning, that is, from the silkworm, which is a farming enterprise, right up to its dyeing and now genetic modification and the development of special nano finishes so you can spill your salad dressing on your tie and just wipe it away. It still occupies that broad range of occupations. It's extremely important as an employer, especially for women at the farming stage, because an ounce of eggs, silkworm eggs, need something like 12 tons of mulberry leaves to fed to it while it's making its cocoon in order to produce the silk that we want. And so it's women who harvest these leaves, and they only eat mulberry leaves, and keep the silkworms in special little trays and keep them clean and keep them fed and so on. And so it's an interesting dichotomy that retains a great deal of ancient practice as well as having come forward. It really was the basis of most scientific developments in fiber technology until, about 1930, 1940, when synthetic fibers began to take over.
I mean, it is so interesting that some parts of the production are just exactly the same as they were thousands of years ago. How do they actually get the little filaments off of the cocoon, you know, into threads that you can use?
Well, they put them into boiling water and spin them around, and that loosens up the fiber on the outside. And the point about this cocoon is it is continuous fiber. So they have to kill the little silkworm inside so that it doesn't eat through, you know, break through itself. They have to stop that progression. And they find the end and just start unreeling. And you can see that process still being done throughout Asia and India, and in fact in Latin America as well. It's still a very important part of a lot of agrarian life styles.
Now, we associate silk with China. Where does the bulk of the world's silk at this point come from? Does it come from China?
Yes, it does come from China, but it didn't always. It came from China until the later part of the 19th century, and then Japan took over, and Japan was the dominant supplier until the Second World War. And there were people, in fact, just before that who commented on this, because the major consumer just before the Second World War was the United States. So they had this interesting relationship with Japan, which became rather complex when the Second World War broke out. After that, Japan never really restored its superiority in producing silk. And the American government, in fact, just after the Second World War, decided that it would be best for China, who was, after all, an ally in the Second World War, best for China to be encouraged to return to its strength in silk, because it was a means by which they could acquire hard currencies. So actually, it was an American policy decision made in the late 1940s that actually determined China would be the source of not only silk but finished silk garments as it is today.
And so what about the silk industries in the whole rest of the world?
Well, they fluctuate. I mean, India is the largest, the second largest producer of silk, but it's also the largest importer of silk. Because, of course, it's a huge nation. And also in India, a Hindu nation, the wearing of silk is essential for certain religious occasions. And on those occasions, they must wear Indian-made silk, Indian-grown silk. And India uniquely also has several varieties of silk, not just the mulberry silk, but also three other main kinds, Eri silk, Muga silk, and Tussa silk. These are called wild silks because they eat things other than the mulberry. They're not quite as domesticated, and they don't produce quite as fine a silk. So if you see a silk that has that lovely sort of nubbly, kind of oatmeal-y quality to it, that's a silk that's come from India.
So not all silkworms eat mulberry leaves.
No, they don't. They don't. But the one that does, Bombyx mori, is the ancient Chinese silkworm, and it is the one that still dominates production because it produces that finest of fibers that's the most absorbent of dyes. But there's a lot of work going on now aiming to genetically modify silkworms so that they can eat other things, so that they can increase the growing of silkworms in places like Africa to help their economy there. And they're also modifying the food. They're actually trying to develop a kind of artificial mulberry leaf, if you like, a kind of the equivalent of a dry kibble for cats, only it's a dry kibble for silkworms, again, so that they can be separated from their dependency on the specific mulberry leaf that they have to eat now.
Why is silk so relatively inexpensive when it seems like at least parts of the production are so labor-intensive?
Well, that's partly just a decision of the marketplace. I think actually silk is probably going to become more expensive, perhaps, and rightly so. It was its price was pushed down dramatically in the 1980s when they developed a way to sand wash it. And that was a process that made it soft and suede-y. I don't know if you can picture all those shirts that we were all wearing in the late 80s and early 90s.
Right, yeah.
And it fuzzed up the silk fiber through this process. So it meant you didn't have to put as much of the fiber into a cloth. You could cheat a bit, if you like, and kind of felt it up a bit, and it made this soft, suede surface. But, in fact, the downside of that was they found that many of the garments made out of it, the seams might rip, for example, because the cloth wasn't very substantial. And so a lot of that product now has, you don't see that on the market, and they're returning to a finer quality. And a lot of that actually has been the decision of the silk industry itself, which really feels strongly that this is the queen of fibers and it should not be debased, it should not be cheapened, and, you know, that it should always be treated as a luxury product and just simply appreciated for what it is. And they have faith that people will buy it for that reason.
Now, silk has been used in rugs. Can it stand up to the traffic of people and camels and so on walking across it?
Oh, yes. I mean, that's why it is traditionally the fiber of Arab and Persian carpets. It is as strong as steel. It has its tensile strength, so that means that you can hang a little thread of silk up and tie it to a heavy stone, a brick, say, and hang the same diameter of steel up, and it will not tolerate the same stress as the silk will. So you can bash it around, you can walk over it, you can do whatever you like. And because also it's so absorbent and takes the color so completely, internally and thoroughly, it isn't like cotton. You know your denim jeans, when you wear them out, they start to go light on the knees or the patches wherever you rub your hands.
Right.
Silk won't do that because cotton is a completely different kind of fiber. It's a vegetable fiber as opposed to an animal fiber. And cotton doesn't absorb the color all the way right into its core. So when you start to wear off the color on the top of cotton, you get that faded patch. That never happens with silk because it's colored all the way through to its core.
Which is one of the many reasons that it's so popular as a garment, as a fabric for garments, mm-hmm. And a good portion of your book is inevitably devoted to the fashion industry and to amazing pictures of articles of clothing.
Well, yes, it is great fun, I must say. You know, one of the privileges of being a historian in this kind of topic is that you do get to immerse yourself in wonderful fashions. I made some fantastic trips to see behind the scenes in Como, where companies like Ratti and Mantero, the great Italian silk producers, are there. And it is fantastic, I must say, to be able to see how much ingenuity they expend on producing the latest, greatest fabrics. And some of these, there's a company in St. Gallen in Switzerland, some of these fabrics are so special. They're made for the couture industry, of course. They cost between $3,000 and $4,000 a yard.
What?
Yes.
That's crazy.
Well, it isn't really, because you see, they're making very limited qualities, you know, quantities of these. Sorry, very limited quantities. And so really what they're doing is, this is the leading edge experimental work. It comes out on the catwalk. It's worth it for the couturier to have something that really is unique. And the ideas that work, of course, then, you know, people take that and begin to work on how it can be made in a more mass-produced way. And we might see it ourselves in the shops, maybe 10 or 15 years later.
So in your book, you also have illustrations of oil paintings of and other works of art from, you know, from the art historical tradition, in which you can recognize the types of silk fabrics that the people are dressed in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do you identify something that's from an oil painting that's, you know, 200, 300 or more years old?
Well, it's partly, of course, that I've spent my whole working life doing this. I suppose that's part of it. But also, of course, the challenge of painting silk was one that was taken up in earnest by a number of painters. I mean, Van Dyck, for example, is famous for those beautiful silk satins that he paints on his sitters. He's painting, of course, in sort of 1630. And his father was a silk dealer, a silk merchant.
Interesting.
So he knew, you know, he was surrounded by silk, really knew what it looked like. But one of the things in his own lifetime that he was famous for was his ability to render that silk so beautifully.
So looking at the silk industry today, in terms of silk as a fabric for our garments and daily life, what is the environmental impact of the silk industry compared to other types of fabric?
Well, this is a really good question, because actually I say to people that when they buy really expensive silk, they have to remember that they're making a donation to the betterment of the world, because silk is the most environmentally friendly fiber. Of course, it's biodegradable. But more than that, because these little silkworms are so sensitive to their environment, they must be kept disease-free. So they can't be raised in an area that has heavy use of pesticides, and that includes the mulberry trees that that are producing the leaves that they're eating. So it's a very low pesticide environment. The actual creation of the fiber, it just takes hot water and a very simple device to pull the threads off of the cocoon, and through the throwing process, all that is very low energy and environmentally friendly. And all the new technologies that are being developed with silk science are also looking very particularly at this very feature. And it's one of the things that the scientists are looking at in aiming to replicate how silk works, including spider silk, in fact, because they want to be able to understand the natural fiber better in order to produce more of it artificially, because it has all these environmental benefits.
When you talk about producing it artificially, you're talking about actually manufacturing it not from silkworms?
Not from silkworms. There's two possibilities just at the moment. One is, believe it or not, it's actually spider silk. If I say cloned, that's probably the simplest way to put it. They've genetically modified the milk ducts of goats to induce them to produce a spider silk, which then solidifies when it hits the air. And that is a more manageable form of producing spider silk, because the spider, of course, can't be domesticated. It produces, actually, its dragline silk is even stronger than the Bombyx mori silkworm silk.
What do you mean by domesticated?
Oh, well, you can't encourage spiders to sit in the same spot and behave. They just cannot. No one has ever managed to domesticate a spider, whereas the silkworm is so domesticated that it cannot survive without the human. It's completely dependent upon its human carers. if you just leave it to its own devices now, because over so many thousands of years it has evolved in this partnership with humans, if you just left it to its own devices, they would just die away.
Isn't that funny? One doesn't think of worms and moths as being domesticatable, you know, sit and stay, but I guess they are.
They are. And in fact, second only to the housefly, which of course is also not domesticated, the silkworm is the single most studied insect in the world. There are more volumes, you know, documenting its behavior and its environment and, you know, how to make it happier and to produce more silk and so on than on any other topic in the natural world.
So silkworms eat organic, non-pesticide laden mulberry leaves, and, and it's a natural fiber, it's biodegradable. What about the dyes used for silk? Chemical dyes have historically been a very big problem environmentally.
They have been a problem, but there are two things going on. The first is that the Germans in the 1990s banned azo dyes, which are the carcinogenic dyes, and they are the largest consumer of fabrics in Europe, that is, notwithstanding Russia. And a lot of silks go through their hands, and so they have determined, certainly for the European market, that there will be no carcinogenic dyes being used at all. And the other feature is that this has helped India, in fact, and China, because they have still many active natural dyeing works, and so they've been able to return to some of this. Although I have to say that some natural dyes, all dyeing actually can be a very nasty process, and any dyer will tell you that you must be very careful when handling these materials because they can be very harmful to you. But natural dyes on the whole do not do such substantial harm to the environment as synthetic dyes do.
So there's much more to talk about, but I want to turn to Lee Zimmerman, who's been sitting here very quietly. Mary Shazer is the author of the book Silk, which is published by Yale University Press, a beautiful book with just excruciatingly lovely photographs all throughout. You're going to be here in Santa Fe, Mary.
Yes, I am. Yes, I'm coming in on the 5th of August. I can't wait. I've never been to Santa Fe before. I'm told it's wonderful.
Well, we look forward to meeting you. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, well, thank you.
And Lee Zimmerman, you are not only the director of the Silk Painters International Festival, you are yourself a silk painter.
Yes.
Yeah. What is silk painting? I mean, it's just painting on silk the way watercolor is painting on paper.
It is, except what we're using we're painting with paintbrushes and we're using dyes. And there's a lot of different techniques. One of the main techniques for doing silk painting is they use what's called a gouda, and they'll draw in their pattern. And the gouda is like a rubber cement that blocks the dyes from flowing through the fibers. And then you'll hit it with the dyes, and the dyes will flow through the fibers and then stop at the edge and form a hard edge. Although there's a lot of other techniques that are being used now for doing these paintings, and they're real paintings with things like landscapes and things with representational work and abstract work.
So it's sort of like high-stakes painting in the sense that, I mean, you're painting on a piece of silk, which is kind of a valuable commodity, and I suppose once you put the first stroke down, you're wedded to it. You can't change it.
Right, you're committed. But it actually, I did a lot of oil painting before I switched to silk painting, and silk painting actually dropped my costs.
Really?
Because there's a lot involved with the oil painting having to do with stretching it, and then also the other thing is that the silk dyes, they blend in a way that the color wheel, that you're taught that the color wheel should, whereas oil paints, when you mix two oil paints together, they may hit the right color, but they don't go down in value. They become muddy. If you do a third, they become muddy. So you can always tell the oil painter. They're the ones with multiple tubes walking around.
Right.
Because they want the freshest, clearest color. I think the thing about the silk painting that's hit most of us is the way that the silk takes in the dye and then what it does to the light when the resulting painting is done. There's something about the silk, maybe it's the translucency of the silk fiber itself, that acts almost like a prism where it pulls in the light and throws it back out at you. There's a sensuousness and a vibrancy that you just don't get from a watercolor or from an oil painting necessarily.
Now, do silk painters tend to paint on the same kind of silk? Is there a special kind of artist silk?
No, they're all over the range. You'll find some people are doing it in a thin silk chiffon, which has certain optical properties. You'll have other people that like maybe a silk satin, which has a shiny finish on the surface, or a silk charmeuse, which is very thick and has a shiny side. And then a lot of them are painting on a habotai silk, which is a kind of a matte surface to it. There's no one particular sort of artist silk.
The Silk Painters International Festival, you've got people coming in, both students and teachers from all over the place.
It's wonderful. We're pulling in people from, I think, about 35 of the United States and the United States. We've got people coming in from Canada, the UK, a lot of people from France, and several from Australia. So we're very dispersed group that are coming in here. And there's some of the best in the world are going to be flowing here. And if somebody wants to see what the silk painting is like, I'd like to direct them to a website if I can.
Yes.
If they go to silkinsantafe.com, and in particular, if you want to see what various silk painters can do, if you go down to the workshop page, the one describing the workshops, and if you click on the workshop teachers' names, it'll flip to their artwork, and you can see just how diverse and
you do everything. I mean, you do still lifes and plein air painting and pattern and everything. It's just like the all the other genres of art.
Right, but there's something about the. The vibrancy of the color that we can get, the richness of the color in the silk fiber, I think, that makes it a little bit different.
So. We're talking to Lee Zimmerman of the Silk Painters International Festival. So there's a lot of events going on. The workshops, some of them are still open. In fact, there's a beginner's workshop.
Right, which is interesting. We're having an international festival. We're bringing experts here, but we're having a beginning workshop. And we wanted to do that.
Well, you're in a town full of artists and potential artists.
That's exactly right. We wanted to be able to invite people in to try out the material if they wanted to. And so they can still, we're holding that one especially open for people if they want to get involved in that. And they can find that on the workshop, the Silk in Santa Fe workshop.
Silkinsantafe.com.
Right.
Now, on Saturday, this coming Saturday, a couple days from now, from 2 to 4 at El Museo Cultural in Santa Fe, there will be a free course titled Introduction to Silk Painting, taught by some of these same painters.
Right. We've got a couple of painters. Jan Janis, who's actually from around here and one of the best painters around, has written a book, several books on silk painting, is one of the teachers. And then we've got another co-teacher that's coming from Quebec, Canada, Jean-Louis Miro, who's a fabulous teacher. And we're also, anybody that shows up early, the members of the silk The Silk Painters International don't realize this, but anybody that shows up early, we're dragging them over to El Museo to be assistants. And one of the silk dyeing suppliers has also generously donated a whole bunch of materials so that we can do sort of a brief introduction to silk painting to anybody that sort of wants to show up and find out what this is all about.
There's also the following Saturday, August 9th, a fashion show at 6 o'clock and a banquet at 7 at the Scottish Rite Temple. That just sounds like big fun.
That should be a lot of fun.
Is it going to be stuff that the people in the workshop have actually made that week?
Well, not exactly that week. But one of the things that we do at this festival, the most important thing that we do at this festival is we set up situations for our membership to show off to each other. And so on Thursday, we'll have an art exhibit. That's up at the Santa Fe Community College. And there's a reception for that. That's on Thursday evening at 6. And that's to show off our painting. And then on Saturday, there's the fashion show at the Scottish Rites Center, which is a very wild place, and it should be a real fun time. And these are, because often a lot of our members do the silk painting, and then they create fashions from those. And those will have a range of things. And so we should be able to see some wonderful things at the Scottish Rites Museum or temple. And if you haven't seen the inside of that, this is a good opportunity to go and check
it
out.
It's an incredible place.
These are open to the public, and you can get tickets for the fashion show, and also you're invited to get tickets to the banquet, which is in the temple too, at the same time. And you can get them on that front page of the silkinsantafe.com website.
Silkinsantafe.com. Is there a phone number that people can call for more information? Or better, just the website?
I think the website is better right now.
Lee Zimmerman is the director of this year's 2008 Silk Painters International Festival. He's an artist. Are you going to be teaching as well?
Yes, I will be teaching one of the courses.
Which is your course?
My course is the figure painting course. So I tend to do things really fast and really large. I can waste a lot of dye.
But. Lee Zimmerman, thank you so much for being here with us.
Okay, thank you very much. It's been enjoyable.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back talking about flamenco. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Juan City. He is with the Juan City Flamenco Theater Company, and dancers and musicians Rebecca Carmona and Carola Sertuche. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you.
And they're performing at the Lodge, which is right here in Santa Fe, Tuesdays through Sundays through the 24th of August. So I went to the performance last night. Lots of fun, very interesting. And I wondered, Juan, you've been doing flamenco for some time. How is flamenco as a musical form and as a dance form evolving and changing?
Young people from today express themselves, and the traditional flamenco is people getting old and people pass away.
Right.
They're going to go to the history books or history channel, or I don't know how to explain that. So we are today, and this is our time right now to do it, to express ourselves.
So, for example, in the traditional flamenco, do men and women touch each other, or do they always stay a slight distance away? I was wondering that because there's just such a little amount of actual contact.
They can be a little bit romance. Depends if it's your partner, life partner, or not, just dance partner. Depends the situation. Mm-hmm.
Now, Rebecca, you are both a dancer and a musician.
Yes, I do both.
So how did you start dancing, and where are you from originally?
I'm from Andalusia, Cordoba, but I live a long time in Germany. That's why my English has a little bit German accent. And now I'm living since 5 years again in Spain. And my father loves flamenco. He was a fan of flamenco, and I always hear in my house flamenco. And since I'm a little girl, I'm dancing and a little bit singing. But I start with dancing. Normally I'm a dancer. And later, maybe 10 years ago, I always sing a little bit, but not so much as now. And 10 years ago, I start more for singing, because then I lived in Germany and there was less singers, and they are always singers need. And they told me, you know, singing, and try, and always I come more. And now I'm dancing, I'm singing, and I wish to play the guitar maybe next 10 years.
Now, all the dancers have to be percussionists with their feet and their hands. Is that that's just part of the, it's part of the dance.
Yes.
How did you start, Carola? You're from Mexico.
I'm from Guadalajara. And I started when I was young, like, I don't know, 10 years, 15.
And so is there a whole world of flamenco happening in Mexico?
Yes, it's a big... You know.
Juan is making some very interesting gestures.
No, but it's a big, you know, Carmen Amaya is one of the greatest flamenco dancers. She went to Mexico, and a lot of her family, like three of her sisters, they stay there. And yes, there is a lot of good artists.
A lot of good artists. Now, to sing flamenco,
yeah.
I was thinking about this last night. Do you have to start smoking unfiltered cigarettes at the age of 12?
To have the voice.
No. I never smoked.
No.
No. I think this is from the Spanish people, the gypsy people, that is the la raza.
So it's just part of the sound. I was thinking when watching it that it was sort of almost like the gypsy flamenco feel is to Spain what American blues is to America.
Yes, you can say that.
So, okay. In this form of dance, did you, Juan, for example, did you study other forms of dance?
No.
No, straight flamenco.
Only flamenco.
And there's no ideal body type for this. Basically, anybody, if they're heavy or they're skinny or they're light or tall or short, can do flamenco.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Everybody.
So you are part of the Maria Benitez troupe.
Been before, yes.
And you talked about the sort of passing of the torch.
Yeah.
Tell us more about that whole process.
Yeah, Maria Benitez, she's not dancing this summer, and she offered us to keep going. She put flamenco on the map here many, many years ago. And I think in Santa Fe, if the tourists come, the high season in the summer, part of their vacation journey is to see a flamenco show. I think it's Maria put this in the map, kind of the tourists that come here, they know her in all the U.S.
You are part German. You've spent a lot of time in Germany. You, Rebecca, also have spent a lot of time in
yes.
Germany. Do you have to turn off the German part of yourself in order to do flamenco?
Yes.
What's up with that?
You just shut down?
No, but there in Germany a lot of Spanish people, and they come together, and
immigrants.
We always be with the immigrants in groups. They come together and make parties and make all they do in Andalusia too.
And are Germans and other Europeans learning flamenco?
Yes, I had for 5 years my own school, flamenco school. Long time ago I was in other schools. And there was a lot of German people that love flamenco. They come to the class, and very good people. Very nice. They do it.
We're talking to the folks from the One City Flamenco Dance Theater, Flamenco Theater Company, which is performing through August at the Lodge here in Santa Fe. Now, in the dance, the costumes, first of all, the girls get all the good costumes.
Yes.
And the costumes are very much part of the dance. Tell us about using fabric, using costumes in the dance.
Oh, but I think it's everything begins through the choreography too, no? Depends what type of dance you are going to do. You figure out the costume and the colors, because it's the same, the meaning, the feeling that you are giving to the choreography.
And you use scarves.
Yes. Anything, no? The
Manton.
Shawls.
Abanico.
Fans.
The
fans.
Fans,
uh-huh.
Yes.
And especially in Carola Solo, she's...
The bata de cola, the big...
Dancing with the bata de cola.
The big dress.
That's right. The
long train.
It's the train on the back of a white wedding dress.
Yes.
Now, do you do all the choreography, Juan?
Not all. There are the solos, the lead people that are invited for this event. They're going to have their solos and express themselves. And then the group numbers, almost with some help and inspiration when we are in the rehearsal studio to finish to create the numbers. Everybody can give it a little
touch.
Touch of their own. How much of what we see on any night is improvisation?
A lot.
A lot.
Yes. A lot.
I think the group's numbers, when all people are dancing, that is almost fixed, because we can not do each one what we want, yes? But when we are dancing alone, each people, then there is a lot of improvisation, because then become the magic of flamenco, mm-hmm. because when you fix it all, you make like a dance, but it's not, I think it's not true flamenco.
Yeah, and it depends of what they are playing or singing. Sometimes they change the letras, so you cannot...
The words of the song.
Yeah.
So you cannot do exactly the same because it's not like together.
So you're responding very much to both the music and the meaning of the song.
Yes.
What are some of the songs about?
A lot of love, death. It's life. All is about life. Happiness, too.
To be angry, too.
All. To angry.
All.
And so, that's the part of it for Americans who are watching. We can't necessarily understand what they're saying or what they're talking about, yes. So we have to get it from the dance. But I'll tell you, if you just get it from the facial expressions on the dancers, quite a bit of anger.
Yeah.
The facial expressions are part of the dance.
A lot. Mm-hmm.
Yes. How do you rehearse that?
No, you don't rehearse that. This is natural, no?
That's the spirit.
It just is what comes out.
We open our heart, our soul. It's like a mirror from inside.
But I think all the people can express, but when somebody is sad, you can see it in his face. When somebody is lucky, or is, you can see it on the face. And then we try to express this meanings. But all the people can do it. You cry, you laugh, you do all... the things we do in our expression.
Right. Now, what are some of the occupational hazards of flamenco? What does it do? What are the detriments to the physical body? It seems very strenuous. I mean, the amount of stomping and pressure just on your bones and muscles is huge.
Well, now we have Pilates. That helps.
Now you stretch.
Yes, stretching and make aerobics and swimming and all, it's good for that. But the best is to go into to make a lot of flamenco, a lot of dancing. It's the best.
So, where else is flamenco danced? I mean, it's danced here, presumably in Japan, because everything's done in Japan that's done anywhere else. Germany, is it... I mean, is it one of those worldwide movements?
Everywhere.
Yes.
Everywhere. If you go on the internet and you Google something, flamenco in New Zealand, flamenco in Finland, in China, in Russia, and everywhere there are flamenco festivals. So it's international.
The people love it, and then they go to Spain and learn it. There is a big school in Madrid. It's called Amor de Dios. If you go there, the classes are full of Japanese people, of American people, of everywhere they come from, everywhere. And they take this and bring it to their country and show there, and they are very good people.
So Juan City is the director of the Juan City Flamenco Theater Company, and they are at the Lodge at Santa Fe. From now through the 24th of August, it's Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You're 6 days a week. Heavy-duty schedule.
Yes.
What do you do the rest of the year?
Either way, performing.
Are you here in Santa Fe, or are you based elsewhere?
Now I'm kind of based here in Santa Fe. I teach classes at Aspen Santa Fe Ballet Studio. They're going to start in the fall again. And besides that, now in August, company members, they're going to offer workshops. And if somebody's interested, just call at 1-505-473-1638.
And is that the same number people can call if they're interested in tickets?
For tickets, the best thing is either way, they can buy them online at www.ticketssantafe.org.
Or call the Lenzik at 988-1234.
Yes, easy number.
Juan City and Rebecca Carmona and Carola Sertuche, thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features an hour dedicated to our artist of the month, McCoy Tyner. And don't forget, tonight at Warehouse 21 from 6 in the evening until 10 at night is the Heart of Salsa benefit for homeless youth. Stay tuned for the BBC, and we will see you tomorrow here on KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. Hasta la vista.